Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we look at voting rights and election laws through the perspective of one of the top American legal specialists in this area. Professor Heather Gerken is the J. Skelly Wright Professor of Law at Yale Law School and a preeminent scholar of election law and constitutional law. She'll be the guest of honor at the University of Tulsa Law Review's annual symposium tomorrow. Legal minds from around the country will debate her ideas about federalism, dissent and democracy, and second-order diversity, three of her specialties. Gerken herself will respond with a lecture at 3:30 tomorrow afternoon at the TU Law School on the changing nature of states' rights, titled Not Your Father's Federalism. Professor Gerken is a graduate of Princeton, the University of Michigan Law School. She later clerked at the Ninth Circuit for Judge Stephen Reinhardt and later at the U.S. Supreme Court for Justice David Souter. She joined the faculty of Harvard Law School in 2000, was granted tenure, and then moved to Yale in 2006. While she'll be speaking on federalism here in Tulsa, I wanted to talk about voting rights and election laws, which has certainly come up time and time again during this 2012 campaign. One disclaimer, while Professor Gerken does advise the Obama campaign, she does not speak for the campaign in any form. I spoke with her earlier this week. Heather Gerken, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
This is the first presidential election since the Citizens United decision. I want to ask you, just as you view the whole electoral campaign, what has been worse than was expected in the wake of the decision? What's not been as bad as we expected after the initial decision?
Well, I think that what people didn't understand about the Citizens United decision is that it was actually very easy for corporations to spend money on electioneering before this. So I think it's a mistake to think that Citizens United is responsible for everything that we're seeing right now. The way that Citizens United really mattered was what it said about when Congress can regulate. So just to give you a quick First Amendment primer, when Congress regulates, it has to have a reason under the First Amendment. And the court pretty dramatically cut back on the reasons that Congress can give for regulation. And in doing so, it has unleashed a chain of lower court decisions which have struck down a number of campaign finance restrictions, which have made possible, for example, the super PACs, which spend money independently and therefore in the court's eyes are not capable of corrupting candidates. There are also just some things that we see right now in terms of spending money that would have been there with or without Citizens United. For example, there are nonprofits called 501c4s and c6s, which spend money in huge amounts without any disclosure of their donors on elections activities. And these organizations are virtually unregulated on this side of the equation because of the failure of the FEC and Congress to take steps. So there are a lot of things that are going on behind this election, and I think there's a tendency to say it's all about Citizens United, but in fact, everyone is responsible for the problems we see.
In fact, the Supreme Court in Citizens United basically in the decision welcomed more disclosure and more transparency.
Yes, exactly.
And they actually encouraged Congress to make that transparency apparent.
You know, the court was almost unanimous on that front about the importance of disclosure and disclaimers, but neither the FEC nor Congress has taken up the court's offer on that front.
Do you think that could be a provision for revisiting this down the road if that, you know, veil of secrecy still remains? Or do you think this court has really spoken on election law at this point? They've reaffirmed the decision at least two times by broadening it in the Free Enterprise Club versus Bennett in Arizona, which was about creating public funding against campaigns that spend too much money in the views of Arizona state law. And the Montana case, where you had a clear history of corruption, they had strict restrictions, and of course the court overturned those laws as well.
Well, what I would say about the disclosure and disclaimers is the Supreme Court ruled with eight justices saying that disclosure and disclaimers are plainly constitutional, and yet we still don't see either the FEC or Congress taking steps to ensure that there's an appropriate level of disclosure for a lot of these organizations. So there's certainly room for work to be done. I think you're right to say that the Supreme Court seems unlikely to budge from the holding in Citizens United itself. The court doesn't tend to reverse itself that quickly, and there are some strong First Amendment advocates there who really believe that the First Amendment requires this, and so they're unlikely, I think, to back down anytime soon.
Now, when the decision first came down, you wrote that you felt like the lasting legacy might not be the flood of money, but the changing definition of what defines corruption. How did this decision change what defines corruption?
So this is what really mattered, and you're right, this is what I was actually just describing. So as I said, when Congress regulates, it has to have a reason, and the reason that Congress has always invoked is corruption. And when the cases first started, what corruption meant was quid pro quo corruption, which means I give you money and you give me a vote. That's the kind of corruption they had in mind. But over the course of many decades, the Supreme Court, particularly the liberal justices, expanded what corruption meant. So soon it became not just I give you money, you give me vote, but the perception that donors were getting undue access to congressional representatives, or the fact that they were getting undue access more than they were entitled to. So all of these things sort of gradually expanded what it meant to be corrupt, even to public perception. And I will just say, you know, the public almost always thinks that Congress is corrupt. So if that's a justification for regulating, Congress has a lot of room to regulate. And so, in fact, what Justice Kennedy did in Citizens United is cut back on that rationale. So you could get a ton of work done without using the word equality, which is progressives' favorite grounds for regulating, but has always been met with a skeptical Supreme Court. You didn't have to use the word equality. You could just say corruption, and the definition of it was so broad, you could do a lot of regulating. Justice Kennedy just cut that back dramatically, and so that's really where the pivot point is in the case.
And his term or phrase was interesting. What was it? Ingratiation and access.
And access. Ingratiation and access are not corruption, was the quote. And before Citizens United, ingratiation and access were corruption. And that is the fundamental difference between Citizens United, and that's why Congress is going to have a much harder time regulating going forward than it has up to now.
Now, you know, the Montana decision, you know, when we talk about corruption as being this limiting force, to me, that was a more telling case, because Montana in the early 1900s, basically the senators bought the seats, and it was well known that they bought the seats from the state legislators. They, in the days before direct election of senators, they would routinely bribe everybody in the legislature, and they won their seat that way. They had this clear history. They put laws in place at that time to stop that practice. And yet when the Montana case came up, even though the corruption was a part of their history, the Supreme Court basically overturned it.
Yes. I mean, I think that was fairly predictable, because although the Montana Supreme Court did invoke its own history, a lot of what it said was, I think, in some serious tension with what the Supreme Court said. And the one thing that's true about the Supreme Court is it doesn't particularly like defiance. It doesn't like defiance from Congress. It doesn't like defiance from state Supreme Courts. And so I had always thought that case was unlikely to be left alone, precisely because the Montana Supreme Court was sufficiently aggressive about it. And the Supreme Court had just issued the decision. It doesn't particularly like lower courts calling into question its decision, and hence we saw what we saw.
I want to ask you, one of the big legal issues in this 2012 election, besides all the influx of money, has been voting rights and the invocation of voter ID acts around the country. Certainly we're seeing some pushback from the court system, but what is the constitutional standing of most of these voter ID acts? I know that was visited before the Supreme Court a year or two ago, and basically the Supreme Court said voter ID laws are pretty much valid as long as everybody has access to getting that ID. Can you maybe comment on that?
Sure. So the Supreme Court decided this issue in a case called Crawford. And the big difference between Crawford and the cases that we're seeing now is that Crawford was this particular kind of challenge, which is, just to give you the legal term, it's called a facial challenge. So essentially the plaintiffs were making the claim that Crawford was just unconstitutional across the board. That's a very rough and not entirely precise way of describing it, but it'll get you there. And what the cases look like now are cases where they're talking about individual sets of plaintiffs. And so they're not just saying we think this is unconstitutional. They're saying here's a set of veterans who have expired IDs and can't get an ID. Here's a set of older people whose driver licenses have expired or who never had a driver's license. Here's a set of people who live in the inner city where they don't have cars, and therefore it's prohibitively expensive to get licenses. So what they're doing is they're going group by group by group to show the specific burden on those people. So rather than worrying about a kind of generic burden about for everyone, they're talking about specific burdens for specific groups. And I think that's why we've seen these cases reach a great deal more success than Crawford did, in part because they're putting people in front of the court and showing what the burdens really look like. And in Crawford, they didn't actually have someone who could say that they hadn't been able to get an ID because they weren't putting specific groups in front of the court. So that may explain the difference between the cases.
Well, you know, it seems like if I remember one of the decisions in the Indiana case, it may have been Scalia, who basically sort of dismissed the idea of there being a cost in getting a ID.
So the justices have a view that I think most people have, which is that, you know, they're used to have the idea that everyone has a driver's license and that you need to present a driver's license for a variety of things, although they actually don't really know. In fact, for example, everyone always says you need to have a driver's license to get on a plane. That's not true. You can get on a plane without a driver's license. But they have a kind of closed view of the world, and they don't interact with the many, many people in the world who don't actually have a photo ID. And in particular, the ones who can't afford it, because oftentimes in order to get a photo ID, you have to go get your birth certificate, and of course that costs money to get your birth certificate. So they do have their doubts, I'm sure, on this front, but they're just wrong about it. That it turns out that there is a segment of the population for which this is quite costly.
Well, in fact, I was at the DMV not too long ago, and I was hearing other people who basically had used public transport to get out to the DMV in a city of the size of Tulsa. That's 2 or 3 hours. And they were told, well, now you have to go to this place to get your birth certificate. You have to go to another place to get a copy of your Social Security card, in which we can offer you an ID card. And I was thinking, if I didn't have transport, that's like a couple of days. You know,
yeah.
It's using our transit system, that's a day's worth of, at least a day's worth of standing in lines and transport to that place. And that has a cost.
Yes, no, that's exactly right. I mean, this is, you know, every other country in the world that's a modern democracy registers its citizens to vote. We're the only major democracy that puts the burdens on our own citizens to cast a ballot. And the problem with that is that we put up all kinds of barriers for people to register. And some of them are for good reason. Some of them are to prevent fraud and to ensure security. But some of them are so burdensome, especially when you think about just the simple fact that every other country in the world manages to register its own citizens without encountering any problems. And you can imagine why, right? We have tax lists of voters. We have a variety of ways in which the government keeps tabs on you, but it refuses to do that on the voting front. And instead, it's the burden is on you to register to vote. And the moment there's a gap, there's an opportunity for the state and for self-interested politicians to manipulate that gap. And there's just also there's room for administrative error. You know, there's just a lot of mistakes that are made in the registration process, which have not because people aren't good people. They are good people. It's not because they aren't trying hard. They are trying hard, but they have very few resources. They don't have enough money to run a really modern registration system. And as a result, you know, people fall through the cracks.
And, you know, when we look at, like, the Constitution says there's no poll tax. Now, that means paying something or passing a test to vote. But it seems like if you're being forced to spend money to get the wherewithal to have the right to vote via IDs and things like that, would that constitute a legal challenge?
Well,
if you can
fact,
document the cost involved in getting an ID to vote?
In fact, that is what a lot of the cases are raising. They're basically arguing that these things cost too much money and are effectively something like a poll tax. And so we'll see how those challenges come. Oftentimes the state will respond by saying that it's going to provide it for free, it's going to make it easier on people. And you know, maybe they will, maybe they won't. I think that's really the question is what it's going to look like in terms of application.
And I think Indiana, in its case, it did offer a free photo ID, but there were a lot of criteria to be met. And again, to get a copy of your birth certificate, to get a Social Security card and the like, that involves spending some money.
Yeah, and the other thing, it's also, I mean, time is money for people, particularly for the people who are most likely not to have an ID are often poor people. And for someone like that, the amount of time spent on a bus to go and do the requisite thing that you need to do, it means taking a day off from work. And it should be, every other democracy in the world does this for its citizens for free. They do it in a way that makes it easy because they believe it's important for everyone to vote. And that's just not the way that we run our democracy. We're an outlier internationally.
And, of course, the conservative argument is that we are trying to combat voter fraud. How well have they made a case in that voter fraud is an actual issue in most elections?
Well, the problem with the claims about voter fraud on in-person, which is what the photo IDs are designed to prevent, so this has nothing to do with the kind of fraud that you might do through absentee ballots or something, but they want to deter in-person fraud voting on election day. And the problem is there just is no evidence that there is a problem with in-person voter fraud. And so now, of course, to be fair, you want to, it's hard to prove a negative, right? So maybe it's true that there's just been rampant voter fraud. We just haven't seen it. But I just think if you just think for a minute, decide you're going to be a sensible criminal, right? Just for a moment, imagine what it would be like to steal an election. And you have lots of choices about how to steal the election. And one choice is you put 50 people on a bus, and you bus from precinct to precinct to precinct, having all of those 50 people give out a different fake name every time, and just hope that not one of the poll workers remembers, actually, Sam down the street died 6 weeks ago. Or, no, I know June Johnson, and you're not June Johnson. So imagine, and you have to keep these 50 people who are going on this bus with you from telling anyone what they're doing, which is, you know, that's a massive conspiracy to keep quiet. So you could do that. That would be one way to steal the election. And you'd have to go to an awful lot of stops. I mean, you need 10 stops to get yourself 500 votes. You need, 100 stops to get yourself to 5,000 votes. It's very tough to gin up votes that way. Or you could bribe a poll worker. Or you could take a bunch of absentee ballots and stuff them in the ballot box quietly with no one seeing. Or you could do what political scientists at Princeton think you can do, which is pop open the back of one of these machines and insert a virus. There are a huge number of ways for a smart person to steal an election. And I got to say, I mean, I don't think the smart person is going to be doing it through in-person voter fraud, because it's just too easy to catch the people. I mean, even the kind of, there have been people who sort of tried to show that it's done, and they've been caught, because it turns out that in-person voting fraud is not our problem. So my friend Nate Persily, who's a professor at Columbia, describes it as a bad solution chasing a non-existent problem. And so we have a non-existent problem, and the solution for this non-existent problem ends up disenfranchising a lot of people. So I believe in security in elections. I think it's nonsense when people tell you that voters don't care about fraud. They care about fraud, and they care about access. It's not an either-or for them. They want to have both easy to vote and register, and they want to be protected against fraud. But the photo ID is designed to address a problem that, as far as anyone can tell, doesn't exist. And that, of course, always makes you a little skeptical about why it is that the people who know a lot about this system think that we should pass these laws. And it's a little bit, you get even more skeptical when you start to realize that these things are often passed with party line votes. So, the election system is run by the same people who run for office. So the refs, they're reffing the game at the same time they're playing the game, and that always leads the temptation to help your side and hurt the other.
My guest today is Heather Gerken, the J. Skelly Wright Professor of Law at Yale Law School. The Tulsa Law Review Symposium will be honoring her work, and she'll actually be a part of that symposium Friday afternoon at 3:30, and when she speaks on the changing nature of federalism at TU's John Rogers Hall. And she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. In addition to being a specialist on federalism, she's also a specialist on election law and voting rights. And I want to talk about one of the articles you wrote this year, which was The 5 Myths About Voting. And number one was that the 2008 election ran smoothly, and we didn't have the problems that we had in 2004 in Ohio or 2000 in Florida. And he said that was basically because the election wasn't that close.
Yes. I mean, so I think one of the things that we don't realize when we watch election controversies is that the problems that we saw in Florida in 2000 and Ohio in 2004 occur routinely at elections across the country. So there are all the time we have problems with these sorts of issues. The key difference is that most elections in the United States aren't close. Incumbents win by such giant margins that it doesn't matter if there's a problem in the system, because the incumbent's going to win by such a big margin. It's only when the election is close that reporters bother to check out what's happening and that people bother to study it. So I was in the boiler room, which is where the Obama team ran their elections in 2008. And across my computer screen was scrolling a list of all the problems in the states that I was overseeing. And I will just tell you that I was looking at the websites for local, state, and national news at the same moment I was watching these problems scroll in. And, in some places it was true. Voting was very smooth. But in other places, the system just sort of broke down as wave after wave of voters crashed down on these polling places. And so But we didn't. None of it was reported, and the reason it wasn't reported was just simple. At 8 o'clock, we knew who the president of the United States was going to be, and there wasn't any point in checking out how the election had been run.
Well, you look at a state like Ohio. Even I'm not sure if it was 2004, but also again in 2008, in certain districts, all of a sudden a lot of voting machines crashed on voting day, And that meant extra long lines. I think in Missouri, they had to hold polls open because of voter problems there. There were lots of problems in 2008, but it didn't really matter because the vote was not that close.
Exactly. And it's a real problem for the way that we think about whether our election system is working, because we're basically trying – what you want to know about an election system is, how does it run every year? What's the annual rainfall for the election system? And the way we're measuring annual rainfall is based on where lightning strikes. You know, and that's not the right strategy. Just because there's a crisis doesn't mean it's the worst election system in the world. It just means it's the election system that happened, got hit with a close election. So what we really need to think about is figuring out a way to measure election performance without having to rely on the kind of crisis in 2000 in Florida and 2004 in Ohio that generated enough news coverage to figure out what was going on.
Now, your myth number two is breakdowns in voting systems are caused by partisanship. That is a myth. Most of the time it's a matter of just voting machines that can't be maintained properly because there's a lack of money. What are some of the other reasons when you have breakdowns?
Yeah, so I don't want to say there isn't partisanship in the system, because there certainly is. The higher you go up, if you've got someone who's running for office, there's a good chance that they're thinking in a partisan way, or at least they're thinking about protecting their own job. Yeah. But the truth of the matter is that for the vast majority of the elections process, you've got really, really good and decent people doing their best with an incredibly hard job, and we just vastly underfund our election system. And so the problem is these people almost are always have a partisan affiliation. They often are put into position because they were involved in party politics. And so what happens? We see a crisis. We see that the person has a partisan affiliation, and we immediately jump to the conclusion that because the crisis isn't happening elsewhere, as far as we know, that it must be partisanship that's the cause. When in fact, you know, the problem is happening everywhere. It's just a close election, and the people were doing the best that they could, but they didn't have a ton of money, and they didn't have a ton of resources. So voting machines is a perfect example. Voting machines cost money, and if you don't have enough of them, you're going to have huge lines, and you're going to have breakdowns during the day. If you don't have enough poll workers, you're going to have all kinds of problems on election day, and almost no one has enough poll workers. There was a recent survey by the federal government that essentially surveyed all the states and asked them, what number of poll workers did you have? And lo and behold, miraculously, 49 of the states reported that in fact they had exactly the right number of poll workers. Down to the, if you just multiplied the number of poll workers required per polling place times the number of polling places, they magically got the right number. Now we know from independent sources that we are missing about half the poll workers we need. So apparently they're all in one state. I actually think the state that reported correctly ought to get the credit.
Right.
They said, yeah, we didn't have enough poll workers.
Another myth was that the only solution is nationally mandated standards. And I think after 2000 and 2004, there was a real call for, you know, these are federal elections. Shouldn't they be federally mandated? You say that's not necessarily the right approach.
Yeah, I mean, so it's certainly the approach that almost all other countries have. But I think what people forget is how highly decentralized our system is. So we have a billion different ways to run the election system with a billion different protocols. In some places, it's the state that's got power. In some places, the locals. Everyone, you know, even from county to county, uses different machines and different ballots. So, you know, it would take a huge amount of work to get us to a national system. I think the better way to think about it is we have an opportunity to experiment. That's the whole point of having a decentralized system. We can figure out what works best. So the first thing we need to do is, like every, you know, it's Brandeis famously said that the states were laboratories of democracy. Well, we do have these laboratories. We're just not recording the results of the experiment. So we need to get some good data on which states are working and which aren't, which systems are working and which aren't. And then over time, what we need to do is we need to think about not national mandates about the way that you need to run your election, but just, you know, national floors. So you can use whatever machine that you want to use, but you can't kick out, you know, X percentage of ballots as uncounted when everyone else is doing much better than that. You know, we won't tell you how to register your voters, but it has to be true that someone with a eighth grade education can register to vote without a problem. Sort of just basic kind of standards about how we expect our election system to be run. That seems like a better strategy. It would leverage our advantage, which is lots of opportunities for experimentation, without requiring us to sort of essentially rethink our entire system from top to bottom.
And that gets us to what you're going to be talking about, the changing nature of federalism, or as you put it in your speech title, not your father's federalism. And progressives have always feared federalism because of civil rights abuses in the South through a good part of the late 19th and 20th century. But you say that federalism has changed and states are a good place for experiments, as you mentioned, on voting rights and election protocols. They're doing interesting, innovative things. They're all doing things their own way, and perhaps it's not so good to fear federalism today.
Yeah, so one of the things that I've noticed, I've written a lot about federalism, about why federalism is good for a democracy, and which is a appeal for both conservatives and progressives, why federalism makes a lot of sense if you care about how well our democracy runs. And I've always found that the conservatives have no problem buying these arguments, and the progressives tend to balk because they worry about racial minorities and they worry about dissenters because of the sort of, you know, the dark history of federalism and the way that states' rights were invoked in the past to justify egregious discrimination. And so the point that the people that I need to really convince tend to be the progressives, and the argument that I'm making is twofold. So the first one is that this isn't your father's federalism. State sovereignty of the sort that used to be invoked doesn't exist anymore. The federal government has an amazing amount of power to regulate when it wants to. And so if there is a problem with discrimination, we have the ability to fix that problem. But the second point, and this is where I think really progressives miss what's going on the ground, is that in fact for the groups that they care the most about, that they think we need a nationalist system to protect, which are racial minorities on the one hand and dissenters on the other, racial minorities and dissenters have a lot of power at lower levels of government, and the reason is simple. It's because that's where they have majorities. So black majority city councils, cities like the city of San Francisco, which is famous for being filled with people who dissent on the same-sex marriage question, cities like small towns in Pennsylvania that mandate teaching, not creationism, but the intelligent design in the school. Those are where dissenters and racial minorities are concentrated, and that's where they actually wield the same power that the majority wields. When you get to the national level, racial minorities and dissenters are, by nature, political minorities. And so the vision I sort of want to put forward is that sometimes it's actually useful to let a group be in the majority, to wield the same power that those in the majority unthinkingly wield, and that's what federalism and localism allows us to do.
Of course, you sort of bring up the dichotomy. A progressive would hail same-sex marriage advocates in San Francisco. They might not hail the advent of intelligent design in rural Pennsylvania.
that's exactly right. Although I will just say to progressives, if you think national politics is an excuse not to fight this stuff out, then you're making a mistake. So if you don't trust politics, if you don't think your ideas are good enough to win in the political sphere, then there's no system that's going to work for you, nationalist or federalism. But what I say to progressives is, of course, there'll be stuff you don't like. Just that's the way a democracy works, and you need to figure out how to battle it and change it, which is perfectly fine to do in a system like our own. I mean, that's the point of it. But it's also, if you look at progressive politics, all the action is on the ground. All the work that's been done in environmental law is being done at the local and state level. All the work that's been done on gay rights is being done at the state and local level. That's where the action is. And it might be useful for academic progressives to notice that what the progressives who are actually involved in politics are doing, which is working on the ground at the states and local level.
All right. We look forward to your speech on Friday. And it's a pleasure to talk with you. Heather Gerken, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Professor Heather Gerken is the J. Skelly Wright Professor of Law at Yale Law School. The Tulsa Law Review Symposium will be honoring her scholarship tomorrow with an all-day-long symposium. She'll be speaking tomorrow afternoon at 3:30. All events take place at the University of Tulsa's John Rogers Hall on the TU campus. She'll be speaking on the changing nature of federalism. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWJS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent shows or want to hear some more of today's show, you can listen later online at publicradiotulsa.org. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.